I guess we can start with questions.
Reverend Jackson, how much financially,
and the number of jobs has Operation Red Vest meant to Blacks in Chicago thus far? Well, it's difficult to tell. We've gotten more than 5,000 jobs directly, jobs averaging better than $8,000 a year. But more importantly, the number of jobs that we have gotten indirectly, because many people began to try to get their houses in motion in order to avoid the stigma of a boycott. The point is, more significant than the detail, is that that there now is a viable force in the Black community organized to cut the margin of profit, literally to destroy the economy of any particular company within our community that we have the margin of profit over. For example, we've put as much emphasis on Black institutional development as we have on getting Black consumers jobs. For example, our two Black banks when we first started were $6 million collectively. They had started about the same time. And the reason they really hadn't grown was not just because of lack of Black accounts, but none of the major institutions in the Black community chose to develop an economic relationship with the Black banks. And in every negotiation that we found ourselves involved in, we challenged them to transfer the tax account, 15-day account that has to go in, and those that could to transfer their commercial accounts to our banks. And of course, the alternative was either to cooperate with our development of Black institutions or to leave the Black community. Two Black banks went from $6 to $34 million collectively in 14 months. We told the chain stores in the Black community that we wanted Black contractors to be the generals in all future stores built in the Black community. Subsequent to that time, we built 9 chain stores, averaging more than $400,000 per store. We've gotten the Black producers on the shelves. We've gotten insurance accounts for the Black insurance companies. We've challenged these same institutions to advertise in the Black newspapers. We've gotten accounts for the Black exterminators, scavengers, and janitorial companies. So the point is, we have literally gone across the gamut dealing with Black institutional development in addition to just getting the jobs. We found, for example, perhaps the most concrete example would be A&P. A&P has 72 stores in Chicago, 40 in the Black community, and only about 4 Black managers. Maybe 2 assistant managers, and that was about it. We told them that that was an illicit relationship. If they wanted a proper relationship, that we should have, if we were the consumers, by more than 90% in 40 stores, that store should reflect our economic relationship with them. And we wanted 40 Black managers, and 40 assistant managers, and 40 produce managers. We wanted the scavenger accounts from those stores, wanted the commercial accounts in our banks right across the gamut that I just showed you. And we were in a confrontation with A&P that lasted from July to October, at which time their hearts hadn't changed very much, but the economic alternatives under which they functioned had so drastically changed until they capitulated. As a result of the power that Blacks manifested economically as opposed to some moral power that whites would manifest, that they never did, in fact.
The president seems to set great store by his Black capitalism program. Do you think it's a sincere effort by the president, or just a tokenism?
Not only is it tokenism, it is dishonest. There is no evidence that he has initiated in the program for Black economic development. I choose not to even deal with the term Black capitalism because it was his phraseology, his attempt to describe what we were doing. But the Black businesses that we've tried to inject the new value system into that have begun to hire our people and to develop decent and dignified relationships between employees and employers, but we've challenged the Black companies to develop profit-sharing plans, we would feel that the value system that we inject is a bit different from the classical value system of capitalism, which speaks of maximum profit and minimum person, and it puts dollar and dime over flesh and blood. Nixon has done nothing to deal with the basic and fundamental problems of the black businessman, whether it's his need for money to develop feasibility studies so as to weigh his ideas, whether it's his inaccess to capital, whether it's the creation and expansion of a market for black businesses, whether it is entrepreneurial training or employee sensitivity training. None of these vital steps in business has the president dealt with. Oh, it was an obvious assassination. I mean, among other things, they say they were fired at with shotguns. And, you know, we've learned not to take cowboy pictures very seriously. They're exciting, but everybody just takes for granted that they're fairy tales for the most part. Now, nobody's going to be expecting somebody to kick a door down and come in and then shoot at them with a shotgun and they dive on the shotgun pellets. That's just inconsistent. And I think what further validates what I'm saying is the mayor from Seattle, who indicated that federal authorities contacted him to cooperate with them on a midnight raid on the Black Panthers in Seattle, and he didn't. And if they did it there, there is reason to believe that they have done it elsewhere. In addition to J. Edgar Hoover, the autocratic leader of the Secret Service agencies of this nation, whose position is very public about their being America's number one enemy. He doesn't see the betrayal of the poor by white leaders or misappropriating our monies in Vietnam or anything else. He sees the blacks who are the effect of a white cause as being the problem. Well, it's very obvious that President Nixon has some commitments to big business and to the Southern political bloc that are far more important to him than any personal humane interest that he may have. For example, he says that we should clean up the environment. Everybody agrees that the pollution should leave the air and the contamination should leave the water. And yet the very businesses that pollute the air and contaminate the water, he intends to give them an additional tax shelter by giving them $10 billion to stop doing what they should not have been doing all the while. So his program for saving fish and fowl is a great one for the rich hunter, but the next day he cuts health, education, and welfare, which means his commitment to saving fish and fowl is greater than his commitment to saving people. But the point that significantly should be brought out is that any time this kind of move is taken on HEW, it affects numerically more poor whites than it does poor blacks. Percentage-wise, it affects more of us, but more poor whites suffer as a result of it.
What are the main thrusts right now?
Well, at this point, perhaps the question can be put more properly as the main thrust of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in that Breadbasket is just a program. Breadbasket is about organizing and structuring the economic power that we have in the communities across the nation where we have chapters. We're basically engaged in four very significant programs now, one having to do with a further extension of the Resurrection City idea, which was to eliminate hunger in the nation. And one of the things that will have to be done that we've not been able to do at this point is to challenge poor whites who live off of the psychic income of pink skin to admit that they are hungry. Of the 40 million persons living off of less than $3,000 a year, 28 million are white. The remaining 12 million are the black and the other minority groups. This must be clearly shown between breakfast feeding programs and challenging the school systems to have to adopt breakfast feeding programs because it is impossible to teach a child abstract mathematics and calculus when he's hungry. And challenging the local governments to use the Child Nutrition Act of 1966. We're trying to make hunger illegal. That's one of our programs. Another program has to do, of course, with health. The health in the black community is very poor because black doctors are not being trained. There are fewer black doctors being trained in 1970 than there were in 1940. We are not getting any aid to develop paramedical aid. The hospitals in the black community are ridiculous, if not altogether non-existent. Mothers without prenatal care, babies developing irreparable brain damage, the whole bit. The health will probably be the next great national drive in terms of something to help liberate the poorer class. The third one, of course, has to do with the political scene. And it's very clear now that some of the Southern senators who said that the 65 voting rights bill was aimed directly at the South, but should have been aimed at the whole nation, they were absolutely right. There are numerically more blacks unregistered to vote in Chicago than in the state of Mississippi, which is political disenfranchisement. Now, all the traditional governmental institutions are available in the black community, the post office, the welfare office, the police station, but voting is not that convenient. So some people were hemmed up, say, in the State Street Housing Project, 6 or 7 miles from downtown, who are average in their allowance 21 cents per person per meal a day, are expected to hire a babysitter, while they pay 50 cents in Chicago to go downtown to register and vote, and 50 cents to come back. There is not even an allowance in their welfare budget for this kind of political development. And the fact is, their welfare position would be jeopardized if it were reported that they used their monies in such a fashion. And right across the North, we will see it more skillfully employed, but there has not been any substantial drive to register blacks to vote because of the general illusion that we function under, that blacks couldn't vote in the South but now can. They always could vote in the North, but they were just apathetic. We now know that it is deeper than that. So that would be one of our drives. And the last one, of course, having to do with the development of the black private economy.
Referring back to the death of Dr. King, probably somewhat even before, has the leadership of the black community become something more fragmented?
No, the
leadership. Do you want to rally behind as they did Dr. King?
No, well, Dr. King probably wouldn't be a good example for that because the world rallied behind him in a way that it doesn't rally behind American presidents. So to compare black leaders with Dr. King would not be fair, not even to compare white leaders with Dr. King would be fair. What really needs to be dealt with is the fact that the black community has always been heterogeneous, has always had a broad cross-section of interests, and people's hollering has always been qualitatively related to their pain. And now we have a broad base of leadership, really with the ship being more important than the leader, because everybody can be a plank in it. The voting bill that SNCC and SCLC were able to get in 1965, while SCLC was in Charleston this year trying to break into the Southern establishment with labor unions, the NAACP, under the leadership of Roy Wilkins, had to save that bill by meeting in Mississippi and bringing its attention to the nation, while the Urban League has significantly dealt with young trained blacks trying to get some employment commensurate with their training so as to minimize their frustration. The Panthers at this point have expressed themselves as a vanguard group who has radically sensitized the nation and heightened many of the contradictions. And nobody can deal around the fact that the Panthers feeding breakfast in the ghettos as poor as they are and our surplus economy not feeding hungry people is an absurd contradiction. They have raised the point that every black community in the nation is militarily occupied, and that if blacks have to shoot themselves free to keep from being embarrassed, that it is a necessary move in survival. Moreover, they have challenged America to let the more than 75,000 black prisoners out of jail. And the basic argument is that blacks who have been locked up, who've had jury trials and juries were not their peers, were locked up unconstitutionally. So I think that just as Foreman has challenged the churches to be Christ-like, and Ennis has challenged the bankers to have some human sensitivity over and against just a concern for profit, that you see a broad base of people talking with different dialects and different styles, but basically about the same thing.
Reverend Jackson, you spoke a moment ago about the voting. How do you view the nomination of Bill Carson?
Oh, I think it is ridiculously, it is ridiculous for the nation. I think it is consistent with President Nixon's obligation to the South.
Reverend Jackson, the people in the South presently, mostly the whites, are objecting to busing and student segregation. In the North, it has switched the other way to some extent, hasn't it? Here in this community, for instance, the blacks are objecting.
Well, what we have found that our greatest concern is now and has always been, number one, quality education. And there has not been equal protection under a common school system. That's why some have even suggested two school systems. But moreover, we find that the standards are of such, until they attempt to put the squeeze on black teachers, the standards are supposed to be so radically different when white students come, until black teachers are squeezed out. Black principals are not given a chance. In other words, the issue in the school crisis is deeper than just some students being bussed here or there. There are some philosophical things that need to be dealt with. There are some intellectual questions that need to be answered. And I think that by and large, people are dealing with that whole issue too much on the surface. I think that when whites dominate blacks rather than participate with blacks, they can expect a negative reaction. Well, I think people ought to go to schools that are, one, schools that are schools, that is, schools that educate people qualitatively. Two, I think that schools ought to be convenient. People ought to go to schools closest to them. Just for background purposes, and I know this is too lengthy for press as such, but in 1954, when I was in South Carolina, I had to walk past three white schools every day going to a black school. And we were going split shift, 8 to 12, 12:15 to 4:15, one teacher per 40 students, using about 18 books that were three-year hand-me-down books from the white schools. And we were also using the white desk. Now, we argued that since our parents were paying public taxes, they should have access to public institutions. I was passing three of them at age 7, 8, 9, going past thoroughfares alone to school, which was dangerous. So we argued that we should be able to go to the school that's closest to our homes, that have the proper educational facilities, chemistry labs, gymnasiums, and what have you. And we finally won that, of course, in 1954, which was a desegregation in a drive for quality education. The whites came out with the term blacks integrate. And integration always has the psychosexual overtones. So everybody gets to reacting based upon the white man's historical guilt about his illicit relationship with blacks through slavery and right on through now. The issue is not now, nor has it ever been, integration between black children sitting beside white children. We know that Russians didn't sit beside American whites. They got Sputnik up. There ain't nothing that you're going to learn necessarily by sitting by whites. But if sitting by whites will assure you the use of a chemistry lab, it will assure you a warm school, it will assure you a proper teacher-student ratio, then it's worthwhile. If that were happening in the black community, one teacher to 16 or 18 students with proper facilities, and on the other hand, the black and the white community was getting one teacher to 40 students, whites would be trying to come to the black community. So basically what you have is a shift toward wherever education is being dispensed, not necessarily where white people reside.
Reverend Jackson, assuming that you can get, as you just mentioned, at least the equal opportunity to have these things by pressing what has been called integration, can you get any kind of a satisfactory living situation in this country for blacks unless something can be done to crack most basic levels of racism?
Well, I think that depends upon the psychiatrist's ability to deal with the white mind. You see, black progress in this country has not been in proportion to black readiness. It has been in proportion to the mental health of whites. That is, their willingness to accept all people as people. I mean, we were ready as a people to use public facilities before 1963, but white folks were not healthy enough mentally to accept us as people. We were ready to vote before 1965 in Selma, but the white mind had not expanded to include us. And I think that whites will have to understand that racism is a matter of a pathological sickness that must be dealt with by doctors and not by politicians. And until whites take their own illness seriously, they are not only going to destroy us, but destroy themselves. Well, you have many blacks now who are the effects of a white cause, who function in tantrums and in frustration because they are bewildered and they are locked in a cave going in circles and don't see a way out. But certainly the one who is the victim cannot be seen as seriously the problem as the one who is the cause.
Is it still racism,
whether
it's black or white?
No, by and large, you do not have blacks, for example, who are philosophically committed to glorifying black skin at the extent of calling us a superior race, genetically superior, just as whites who turn skin worship into a religion. You had intellectual theorists taught at this university, for example, the Teutonic theory of racial origins, which Bishop William Stubbs started in Oxford, and it leaped the Atlantic to Harvard, Oxford, and Columbia University, a whole theory work out proving the genetic inferiority of blacks and the superiority of the Western European white mind. You had here whites who will die and disinherit their families to keep their skins pink. So you do not have blacks with this kind of commitment. What you do have now are blacks who, for years, who locked in the system with a 9-to-1 white to black ratio, felt themselves to be inferior and really were disenfranchised from their person. So for the long years of discrimination, you now hear black pride, black pride, black pride, which is compensation. But it is not to the point of developing some intellectual theory proving that whites are inferior. It is just to prove that blacks are equal and should be viable participants in the human community.